Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we'll meet Kendra Brooks, the third-party candidate who broke the two-party mold on Philadelphia City Council. She assumes her at-large seat in just about a week. Also, it's off to the playoffs for the Philadelphia Eagles. We'll talk about the Birds' huge win against the Giants on Sunday with the Philadelphia Inquirer's Les Bowen. But to begin, we bring you the latest on a story which propelled the Neshaminy School District into the national spotlight. The Bucks County District has been fighting a lawsuit over its use of the word Redskins as a name for some of its sports teams. Litigation also involves logos and imagery. It's come to light recently that the district has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money in its legal battle, and the tab is likely to grow bigger. The district is appealing a recent decision handed down by the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. WHYY's Aaron Moselle has been following this story, and he joins us now in studio. Good to have you with us, Aaron.
Thanks, Mary.
Before we get to the money piece of it, let's take a quick look at the commission's recent ruling, which was effectively a split decision.
Right, and you could say it's sort of a partial victory for the district, who has for years been fighting to keep this name Redskins, this longtime name for some of its sports teams, mostly at the high school. And so the decision effectively is you can keep the name Redskins, but you got to get rid of the related imagery and logos that kind of go with it. So the football team is typically called the Skins. That's what's on their helmet. The baseball team has a tomahawk on their caps. The basketball team is represented by this sort of Native American warrior. And so it's unclear if all of those or some of those would have to go, but they just said that anything that's negatively stereotyping Native Americans has to be gotten rid of.
So the commission didn't offer anything more specific in its guidance?
There's nothing really specific, which causes the school board some real trouble because they don't really know what they're supposed to do. And they also don't know how much it's going to cost them. And that's one of their arguments against this ruling is that, hey, if we have to get rid of all this stuff, it could cost up to $1 million. I'm not sure exactly where they're getting that figure. It has been cited in some legal paperwork, but it's not rooted in anything that the commission has spelled out because they haven't spelled anything out.
Mm. So at least for the school board's part, it might be actually less expensive to pursue the litigation and to appeal than to go and actually spend, they say, $1 million to remove logos and other imagery. Okay. Aaron, the word Redskins is offensive to many people. Was there a sense of surprise and confusion about the commission's decision to let that word stand as far as names for some of the high school teams?
Right. When you go through the opinion, it's sort of it is confusing, to say the very least, because at various points throughout the opinion, they say, we recognize that this is a racial slur. We recognize that it's derogatory. We recognize that high schools should not be naming their teams the Redskins. And then at the end, they say, well, but you can keep the Redskins as long as you kind of teach kids about negative stereotyping generally, not even specifically to Native Americans. And in terms of kind of how they make this rationale, they say in the opinion, I'm going to quote from it, it says, Redskins alone has been shown to evoke feelings of loyalty in many. It is stereotypical logos and images that pose a problem.
It's confusing.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
There's no other way to really say it.
They didn't make a hard and fast decision one way or the other. No. It seems as if there was a little waffling.
Correct. Yeah.
Hmm. Another part of the ruling requires the district to educate students about negative stereotypes. Again, was the PHRC specific as to what this education involves?
There's not a lot of detail there either. And the school board is saying, you know, it's not their right to tell us how to educate our students. That's our decision. That's the Neshaminy School District's decision. And that's part of the reason why they're appealing this decision.
Okay. What does the district say about use of the word Redskins as a name for some of its sports teams? You would think that, you know, many on the board are okay with this since they continue to fight to be able to use that word.
Yeah, I mean, the school district has been quiet on this because it's a legal proceeding. The school board has been less quiet and has even released, released a statement sort of saying why they aren't in agreement with the commission's decision. But underlying all this, as you're saying, is that they don't really have a problem with this name. To them, it's sort of a point of pride. It's tradition. They've had this name for well over 50 years. And if you talk to a lot of people in Neshaminy, they say, you know, this is really our tribute to the Native American history that that has been here.
Mm. Did any Native American students testify in this case?
They did not, and that was actually a critical point that was raised in the commission's decision. The Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission said, this name and these logos, they're creating this hostile educational environment for district students. That was sort of a major point of why they brought up this lawsuit. And when they actually came down to the ruling, they said, well, we can't prove that because no Native American students testified to that harm. Which isn't that surprising, because if you look at the demographics of Bucks County at large, where this school is, you know, it's well over 80% white, and I think less than 1% Native American. So there are a couple of students that have Native American lineage at this school, but there aren't a ton. But they said, because no one stood up and said that they've been harmed personally because of this, that we can't give that one to you.
So, again, the school district has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars defending the name and imagery over, what was it, like a half a century? Because, I shouldn't say, no, it hasn't been a half a century in terms of the litigation, but they've been in place for about a half a century,
right.
I think it is. Yeah.
The name, yeah.
So, but the school district has spent a lot of money. How much of this sum are taxpayers on the hook for? Most, all of it?
Mostly, most of it. So, since 2013, the district has spent well over $400,000 defending this name. There was a complaint that a parent filed with the commission. There was this most recent lawsuit that we've been discussing, and there was also a battle with some student editors who wanted to keep the name out of the newspaper. Some of that sum was covered by liability insurance, and the rest of it has come directly out of pocket, more than $300,000. And then anything from now on is also going to be directly from taxpayers' pockets. The appeal, which is estimated to cost around $20,000.
And, you know, I haven't seen this in your reporting, but have you seen out there reaction from taxpayers at all? I haven't seen this anywhere, really, talking to just, you know, men and women on the street about how they're feeling about this in Bucks County, the Neshaminy area.
Yeah, when I posted the news about the $400,000 on Twitter, there was quite a lot of commenting, and there was also a lot of commenting on Facebook. I mean, a lot of it was coming from the Philadelphia audience who's looking up at Bucks County saying, you guys have this much money to spend on this, and we're here scrambling for cash day in and day out. But there were some folks from the Neshaminy School District as well, from the community, saying this is really just not okay.
Yeah. Were any in favor of it that you heard of, that you saw on Twitter or on Facebook?
I didn't see any social media support, but I got to say that in the 6 years that I've been covering this story, I have come across very few people in the Neshaminy community who have a problem with this name.
Okay. And again, the district's board of directors is unapologetic about everything.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned 6 years. You've been on the story for quite a while, and the story has been unfolding for at least 6 years. It all began, I believe, with a former school district parent. I think her name is Donna Fan Boyle, and she is has some Native American ancestry. Do you recall, Aaron, what it was, you know, how did she begin this saga, if you will? Did she file a complaint with whom? Do you remember?
So she filed a complaint with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission,
okay.
in large part because she had a son at the time who was at the high school. And she kind of held on to the complaint for a couple years. And ultimately, she was getting a lot of backlash from the community because she was fighting this. Because, as I said, the majority of the community is okay with it, and they found her to be problematic as someone who wanted to get rid of this name. So she withdraws her complaint, and then the Human Relations Commission, their staff, take up the suit in her place and sue the district. And that's sort of how we got to where we are today.
It also moved over to, as you mentioned earlier in the segment, to the high school newspaper. I think it's called the Playwickian. And some student editors took up the cause. But again, there was pushback here, I guess, within the paper. And the commission did come to a decision regarding how these young people can handle the name.
So the commission wasn't...
Or was it the board?
The
school board.
I'm sorry. Right,
okay.
The board. So the same year that Donna Fan Boyle filed her complaint, the student editors at the Playwickian, the Neshaminy High School's student newspaper, they said, you know what, we don't want to print this word at all. They weren't calling for an outright ban. They just wanted to say, we find it to be a racial slur. We're going to remove it from our pages. And the district and the school board fought them very hard.
Did they?
It turned into a national story.
First Amendment rights?
Yep. Yep, the students got some backing from some national law groups. Ultimately, the school board came down and said, you know, you can print them in news articles. I mean, you can remove the word from news articles, but you got to print it in editorials. And that's the way it's been.
Yeah. Who pays for this part of the argument? For this, do you know how that is funded? The story regarding the Play Wiccan?
That is part of the more than $400,000 that we talked about. It's all part of it because the district did have legal representation there.
So the students are not on the hook for any of this.
No, they're not.
Okay. Have any other names, to the best of your knowledge, been bandied about, or is it really just sticking with the name Redskins?
I have heard no alternatives. The hope from folks on the commission and from folks like Donna Van Boyle, or the hope was, I should say, now that we have an appeal, was that they would sort of get together, start talking about getting rid of the logos, getting rid of the imagery, and that somehow they would sort of figure out that, you know, maybe we should just get rid of the name as well because we're already getting rid of this other stuff. That's now all up in the air because we don't know the way that this appeal is going to go.
How long might it last? Is there any sense as to how long this story might play out?
Courts can move pretty slowly sometimes, and, I would be surprised if it was anything less than a year or two.
Yeah. Is Donna Van Boyle, she kind of standing to the sideline now with this story? Do we hear more from her these days?
You know, I check in with her every time there's a new development, and, you know, her outrage continues. And
it can be tough to be on social media these days to put yourself out there.
Yeah, I think she's a little gun shy, but I think she's always been willing to talk to press because she believes so strongly in this. And she's told me over and over, I'm not backing down. I'm not going away.
And again, back to taxpayer expense. How does the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission generally consider cost in cases like this?
It doesn't appear to be a consideration. They don't file a lot of suits, but when I asked them how much money they've spent personally, because we're talking, again, about taxpayer dollars on their end as well, in addition to the district, they said, we don't break it down that way. So they told me we don't have a figure for how much we've spent pursuing this Neshaminy case on its own.
All right. Well, keep us posted. Thank you so much.
Will do. Thanks, Mary.
All right. WHYY's Aaron Moselle. Stay with us here for the Radio Times Regional Roundup. Up next, Kendra Brooks, one of Philadelphia's newly elected city council persons. She's with the Working Families Party. It's a great story. And then after that, we're going to talk about the Philadelphia Eagles' big win over the Giants. Off to the playoffs. Keep it here.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In just a few minutes, we talk about the Eagles' big win. 888-477-9499 is the number if you'd like to call and tell us what you think. But first, January 6th will be an historic day for Philadelphia City Council. Kendra Brooks will be sworn in as an at-large member. Brooks is unique in that she does not belong to either the Democratic or Republican parties. She's a member of the Progressive Working Family Party, and as such will be the first third party member to hold a seat on council in about a century. So what does Brooks bring to the table, and realistically, how much of a voice can she expect to have as one of a governing body of 17? We will ask her. Kendra Brooks is with us now for Radio Times. Welcome.
Well, good morning.
Good morning to you. Kendra, you take your seat in about a week. What's going through your mind?
Oh, wow. So many thoughts. I'm just really excited. I think I've spent like the last couple of weeks since Election Day kind of getting to know my colleagues. So I'm really excited about what we can do together here for Philadelphia. I think the mystique with running as a third party candidate and with me, you know, being a progressive and like a lefty or whatever terms people want to classify, I think I've found like decent mutual ground with most of my colleagues, and I'm really excited for us to kind of dive in and begin working for people here in Philadelphia.
So even as you are, you know, finding mutual ground with your colleagues, you've also been quoted as saying, "I'm not going in there to make friends."
Yeah, well, we're here to do a job. Yeah. You know, I came in, you know, to, you know, do something different, to work hard for the people. Not that my colleagues weren't, but that's what I came to do. And I think during the process, it was important for me to meet with my colleagues, because in order to pass any bills or policies, we need to have allies. And part of having allies is building some kind of shared mutual understanding on issues that are important to me and important to my colleagues, because the only way we'll be able to win is by finding a way we can work together. So, yeah, to me, that's work relationships aren't necessarily friendships. Hmm. We'll see what happens along the way. But, yeah, I'm coming here to do a job for the people, and I'm just really excited about what's possible.
Why choose the Working Families Party as your party?
I think my decision was based on the fact that I was able to just run a campaign and not being beholden to any of the traditional trajectories that have been put out by either party. Even though, you know, people across parties share some of my same views, I can consistently focus on that thing, those things that I was focused on based on helping working people in Philly and issues that affect working people in Philly without getting any additional permission, so to say, on how I should move or how I can move on those issues during my campaign. So for me, being a part of the Working Families gives me the opportunity to be like an additional voice on council, and maybe sometime even louder on really, you know, progressive issues.
You have not been in politics all that long. I think it started, what, about 5 years ago, Kendra, with an education issue in your own backyard in Nicetown?
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't enter this as a politician. I entered this world as an activist and organizer. And, you know, my passion that I have for organizing and communities is the same passion that I'm bringing onto this side as I learn the politics in it all.
Well, let's talk briefly about that education question that you tackled, I guess, about 5 years ago. You led parent opposition of a plan that would have turned your local elementary school in Nicetown into a charter school. That school, by the way, did stay in district hands. Charters versus traditional public schools. As we all know, charter schools are a popular option for many parents in Philly. There are waiting lists to get these kids into these schools. How do you, Kendra, envision the role of charter schools in the Philadelphia School District?
I ran on a campaign saying that we need a moratorium on charters. We don't need to do any new charters until we figure out how our existing schools are fiscally stable. And that has been my position. I understand that parents choose charters because traditional public school systems have not always been, or just to be true, have failed some communities drastically, and charter offered a different opportunity. However, we're at a point now that some of the charter schools are still only performing equally or marginally better than our traditional public schools. And currently we're in a financial crisis in funding them all. So I'm really strong on a moratorium on charters until we figure out, you know, what our existing education system here for Philadelphia. I don't knock any parent for choosing charters. That just has not been my choice.
Many Philadelphians, as we know, are mired in poverty, over a quarter of all residents, and the deep poverty rate has been going up. Deep poverty, meaning a family of four has an income of no more than $12,300 a year. Kendra Brooks, this crisis has existed for many, many years in Philadelphia. The city can't seem to gain any traction in resolving it. Where would you begin?
I think for me, it's like multi steps. So one of the things I've been speaking a lot about is housing. We're in a housing crisis here in the city. Housing is not affordable. So that same family with a medium income of $12,000 could barely afford to live anywhere in the city. And we're at a time where public housing is shrinking. Subsidized housing is shrinking. The Section 8 wait list is extremely years long. So we're not offering opportunities for families to be able to sustain. So affordable, low-income housing is definitely one thing that's on my list, and that's something that we can work on. Also, how can we work towards people having quality jobs here in the city? So yes, we need more jobs in the city, but they need to be quality jobs, paying people a living wage. And some of this stuff is preempted by the state, but there are things that we can do on a local level to help, you know, stimulate some level of growth and income for, you know, low-income families. Also, making sure people have access to existing city services that could offer some level of relief. Currently, the way the systems operate, there are long lines, and, you know, people have to take off work to access services. Those are things that we can look at immediately to help resolve some of these, you know, some of the poverty issues. And the other thing is, I've always been a proponent of education. We need jobs and opportunities for people to have pathways out of poverty that we haven't seen before. We need to be creative with that.
I think you dropped out there. Would you mind repeating your last sentence, Kendra?
We need to be creative in what that looks like, and it's going to require multiple agencies coming together, whether it's housing, whether it's job growth, whether it's education. All of these things need to come together to create a package to help pull us out of this state of poverty that we have here in Philadelphia.
You're from the Nicetown neighborhood. A federal survey out last year showed a drop in the median household income of Tioga Nicetown from just over $28,000 to about $17,500. So, you know, bring this home for us. What are some of your neighbors experiencing?
I mean, rapid job losses, like, you know, or reducing of hours. So, like, people have jobs, but you're working multiple part-time jobs, trying to juggle all of this together. And it makes it really difficult. And we also see that more people are moving into homes because gentrification and displacement is real in our city. So we have more families that are doubling up, which means there are more people in the neighborhood, but less people that are working. And we need it's a crisis. It's real. And I think that it's not that people don't want to work. I think the quality or the availability of quality jobs is definitely an issue, or even the adequate training to access some of these jobs.
The Working Families Party, Kendra, supports a $15 an hour minimum wage. Pennsylvania's minimum stands at $7.25 an hour. Those who say $15 an hour won't work, in particular, smaller businesses, say if you double the wage, we might have to cut hours or even jobs. You know, at the start of this segment, you were talking about working with your colleagues. In your mind, how can we make this work for all sides? Raise the minimum and yet keep small businesses solid.
I mean, the argument about raising the minimum wage, I want to be very clear. When I had my first daughter at 18, my first job, I made $6.80 an hour. That was 29 years ago. So it's no reason for 29 years wages only went up a few cents. Like, that is ridiculous. I think the minimum wage increase should follow inflation and the cost of living, and we haven't seen that. I think that we'll have to figure out some other incentives for small business to be able to thrive in the city. If it's causing a severe undue hardship for them to pay their employees a living wage. And I, like I said, everyone is going to have to chip in to make sure that we're pulling each other out of this. And I understand that, you know, small businesses say they might have to reduce hours. But in reality, some people are actually still working 7.25 and doing more than the expected hours that they have anyway. I think if you have a small business and your employees are loyal to you, you'll be able to work out some things. But I think that varies from business to business. But I think it's worth the conversation. But I still hold true that in 29 years, minimum wage has not raised drastically, but we see the cost of living in Philadelphia skyrocketing. And we have to do something about that. It's unacceptable.
Getting back to your the early days of your political career, you got a chance to rub elbows with the traditional political establishment recently, earlier this month, that you attended the Pennsylvania Society. And for those who aren't familiar with it, it's every year politicians, future candidates, and others get together in Manhattan to hobnob and fundraise. What was that like for you as somebody who's relatively new to the political scene? And it's perhaps a political outsider as a member of a third party.
For me, it was definitely eye opening.
How so?
My colleagues insisted that I come, so I went, and people were very nice, very open. A lot of conversations. I had an opportunity to meet folks that I have never met, on a campaign trail. I kind of got an idea of how, this all works. This is a very social event. And you get to see people outside of their traditional element, and engage in some deep conversations. And it was definitely an experience.
So the tax abatement, the controversial tax abatement, there's a new tax abatement law ahead. The value of the current incentive for new residential construction will eventually be cut in half. The Working Families Party wanted to see the abatement eliminated entirely. Again, you haven't quite yet assumed your seat on council, but Kendra, fair to ask, is this your first disappointment as an elected official?
I took it twofold. I took at it, this is not exactly what we wanted. However, it's a $150 million benefit for Philadelphia schools. I kind of balanced out the loss with a win. No, this is not what I wanted. But it wasn't a complete wash. I think there are other things that we can continue to do, around tax abatement, around housing issues, around funding for schools, that we'll have to figure out what that looks like in our new council session. I spent a lot of time fighting to end the 10-year tax abatement. So yes, I was a little disappointed, but you take a piece of the opportunity means that we were fighting for funding for schools and we got something.
Again,
not enough, but it was something.
Again, you're one voice out of 17 on council. What do you plan to do to make sure your voice is heard?
I'm a coalition builder. I've been working with coalitions around the country and locally, and I will continue to talk to my colleagues as we move stuff along. I will continue to be a voice on things that I feel very strong about and things that my constituency felt was important. I don't think so. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Please forgive me. I'm in someone else's office.
It's live radio, and that's just fine. So getting perhaps to a little bit of your personal background, I was reading a news article from the Aldea News Service. You've always been an outspoken person, even as a child, Kendra?
Yeah, just kind of speak what's on my mind. I don't know. I guess people always joke and say that what comes with women of small stature. We usually have a lot to say. So I think that this is kind of the perfect role for me to be in, just to continue to be a voice for the people like I have most of my life, whether it was bullying when I was little to fighting for a school in my neighborhood a few years ago, or issues around disability rights when I worked with children and adults with disabilities. I think that has been kind of my calling. So I'm really excited to be in this position to continue to speak up for, people that may not be in the room.
You have, you've got four children?
Yes, I have four birth children and one adopted. I call her my bonus.
So what does your family think of your political career?
They're getting used to to me not being around as much. I think that my daughters are very excited about all of this. I think the transition with everything that we do being very public, and my ability not to be home with them as much, is kind of what the biggest adjustment is. But we had a whole like year through campaigning. It was pretty much the same. So I'm excited to see once we get settled in office, how my schedule will be able to balance out me being a mom and city council all together in a different way than what I'm currently seeing now. So this has been a lot.
Any other issues you'd like to see targeted in your first session with council, Kendra?
Another thing that has been dear to me is the gun violence issue. Throughout my campaign, like, I hold true that my children have buried more friends in their lifetime than I have. So I definitely plan on working very hard with my colleagues around issues with gun violence here in the city. That's something that keeps me up at night.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but which first steps would you like to see taken to start to address this, again, this unending crisis in Philadelphia?
Oh, so many. Oh, first steps. Prevention. I think we need to have more prevention programs on the table. I think that's the quickest first step. The second step is making sure we have, solution-based programs for young people that are affected by the issues. I think those are the two things that kind of connect it.
All right. I'm sure we'll be speaking again. We really appreciate you joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you. You have a great day.
You too, Kendra.
All righty.
Kendra Brooks is soon to take her at-large seat with Philadelphia City Council. Keep it here for Radio Times. We'll be talking about the Eagles' high-stakes win against the Giants in just a few minutes. And if you'd like to call in, it's 888-477-9499 or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Who would have thought just a few weeks ago that a banged-up Eagles team, fresh off a loss to the lowly Dolphins, would make it to the playoffs as the NFC East champions? The weather at the Meadowlands on Sunday was miserable, a steady rain with temperatures in the low 40s. But no matter, at the end of the day, it was Eagles over the Giants, 34-17. Carson Wentz, as quarterback, was brilliant, and there were some other big surprises. Guys called up from the practice squad made all the difference, including a new star by the name of Brandon Scott. I should say Boston Scott. Sorry about that. We'll be talking about the Eagles' 2019 campaign for the rest of the show and what lies ahead. If you'd like to join us again, the number to call is 888-477-9499 or send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Les Bowen is a sports writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and joins us now for Radio Times. Hi, Les. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Mary. My pleasure.
So how would you characterize this win?
Well, it was hard-fought, I think, would be the way I characterize it. It was tied going into the fourth quarter. The Eagles, incredibly, lost two more important players. We don't know for how long. Their best remaining weapon, Miles Sanders, went out with an ankle injury in the second quarter. And then later in the second quarter, Brandon Brooks, their most consistent offensive lineman, a three-time Pro Bowl selection, including this year, went down on an extra point, which is hard to do. If you've ever seen extra points, they're kind of perfunctory plays. Not much really happens most of the time, but somehow Brandon Brooks suffered a dislocated shoulder and was in tremendous pain on the field, as you could see on the broadcast. So, yeah, they really had to fight, but in the fourth quarter they got a very crucial turnover, fumbled snap, and the dam kind of burst from there. They were really determined to win this game. They had to win it to get into the postseason. They wouldn't have had to win it if Dallas had lost, but Dallas didn't cooperate there and won very handily. So the Eagles had to win, and they did, and they are the NFC East champions against all odds.
So against all odds, indeed. You know, what percentage of this team, as far as the regular players, is out?
Well, that's a very good question. Doug Peterson has a noon press conference, but we're probably not going to get a lot of definitive answers this early in the week. Certainly, they will be missing more than half a dozen of the scheduled starters when the season began, when they take on the Seattle Seahawks at Lincoln Financial Field next Sunday. But it could be as many as 10 or so really key players. We just don't know. People will try to play because this is the playoffs and it's really important. But, you know, you don't always get medical okay to play just because you want to. They're not going to let you do anything that will compromise you in the future, you know, that kind of thing. It's really unclear at this point who they can get back. And there'll be some guys that will be out there, certainly. Maybe Lane Johnson, who's been sidelined with a high ankle sprain. I think there's a good chance he tries to make it back this week. And I think Miles Sanders maybe wasn't that bad an injury yesterday. So we'll just have to see as the week goes on.
So, well, still, Eagles Nation is, of course, hoping, and the practice squad really stepped up. To use a baseball analogy, stepped up to the plate.
It really did, and that's not something you really expect. The way the practice squad works, for WHYY listeners who might not be tuned to the arcana of the NFL, they have these guys. They have 10 guys that aren't really on the team. They're on a sort of supplemental group that is there to fill in practice for injured players and to kind of mimic the other team that they're playing that week, to give a look, to give a scout team approximation of what the other team is going to do. And these players, they're sort of on perpetual waivers. Other teams can sign them to the regular roster if they want, which happens every now and then. You're sort of on the team, but you're not on the team. You don't ever play in games. You don't travel with the team. But they can dip into this squad, obviously, if they want to bring guys up to the 53-man roster and play them. And the Eagles have had to do that with almost the entire squad this year. And it's worked out much better than you would think.
Boston Scott.
Yeah. You know, this is a guy, he came here a year ago from the New Orleans practice squad. New Orleans had a very deep running back group, and they had stashed him on the practice squad. He's a little stubby guy from Louisiana.
He's 5'7".
Really,
compared to the regular, most of the other guys.
Right.
You know, that's a physical
but he's
challenge.
He's like a bodybuilder. He's really, really a powerful little guy. And you know, you could tell he had potential all along, but the Eagles had a very similar player in Darren Sproles, who's a kind of an all-time great with the same stature. And they brought Darren Sproles back for one more year at age 36, and they really didn't have a spot for Boston Scott. They put him back on the practice squad when the season started. And I was thinking at the time, this is really unfortunate, because while Sproles might have something left, Boston Scott is really an interesting player. It would be really beneficial to them in the long run to see what he can do. But they kind of didn't until they had to. They had a bunch of injuries. Jordan Howard, their leading rusher, went down for 6 games. Darren Sproles went down yet again. I think his career is done now. Hmm. So they had to actually bring up Boston Scott. And lo and behold, he is quite the explosive you know, really reliable, tough little player.
And, 3 touchdowns yesterday.
Yeah, and he set up one of his touchdowns with an incredible 39-yard spinning, darting run after a catch on a screen pass. It's the Giants. I mean, you're not playing a great team. They won 4 games all year, but still it was clutch, and it was very much needed. And, you know, it kind of shows this guy's potential, and he's really – he seems to be a really great guy who has worked hard to get this chance in the NFL, and I know it means a lot to him. And I think that's part of the dynamic with these practice squad guys. they're just hanging on by their fingernails to the NFL when they're on the practice squad. I mean, they can just kick you off of that at any time. You don't make as much money as the regular players. You're kind of – a lot of the – some of them have temporary lockers. They have these temporary locker stalls in the middle of the room that kind of are on wheels. And they can just take away your nameplate and, you know, send you on your way at any moment.
And now they are the heart, really, of this Eagles squad, which is moving forward into the playoffs. Well, it's a terrific story. It's a lot of fun. Unless they are, you know, there was this whole thing with the underdogs a couple of years ago. They are truly the underdogs going into the postseason up against, you know, a pretty good Seahawks team next week.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The Seahawks are kind of like the Eagles. They would probably have gotten a first-round bye and been one of the top-seeded teams in the NFC if they hadn't had an onslaught of injuries, very much like the Eagles. They lost last night to San Francisco in a game that could have gotten them a much higher playoff seed. They almost won it, but they didn't. They brought back Marshawn Lynch, their retired running back, this week, and he scored a touchdown for them last night. So it's kind of it'll be interesting. The first line I saw had the Eagles favored by a point, just because as absurd as the Eagles' injury situation is, the Seahawks' situation isn't much better. However, the Seahawks' quarterback is Russell Wilson, who has just been a magician, and especially against the Eagles. He's never lost to the Eagles.
Really?
The Seahawks won here last month, or I guess it was November.
Late November.
November was last month. We're still in December, aren't we?
Almost out of it.
This time of year is hard for me. It's really. The Seahawks beat the Eagles, but it was a very close game. Russell Wilson really didn't play that well. The Eagles have a good chance this week if they can get a few people back. They are at home. Seattle's got to cross the continent. If you've ever been to Seattle, that's a darn long way from here. It's almost like flying to London.
I have been to Seattle many times, and it's a day-long trip, but a beautiful city, and I'm well familiar with the 12th man mentality out there. As we kind of head toward the top of the show, I'd like to take a quick look at Carson Wentz, the quarterback for the Eagles. Mm-hmm. And what's been happening for Wentz in the month of December? Early this month, again, there was a gut-wrenching loss to the Dolphins, who've had a really rough year. After that, Wentz was terrific late in the game in each of the games against the Giants and the Redskins, the earlier game against the Giants, and even better against the Cowboys. What do you think has been happening with Carson Wentz? Is he finally realizing the potential that the front office was hoping was there?
Boy, that's a good question, Mary. I kind of think a lot of it has been getting in sync with all of these new weapons and figuring out what people can do and how to best use them and what kinds of passes to throw to these guys. And with the total change in weapons, none of his three opening game wide receivers is still available. So he's had to sort of, they spend months in the summer, in the spring and summer, working on timing and execution with the starters. Yeah. And then you have guys that weren't even on the team, and you're trying in the middle of the season to sort of jerry-rig all this. But I think that was a lot of it. And I think he has kind of hit a groove with these guys. I think there was a staleness, frankly, with the offense for a while there. There were some guys that were being depended upon who maybe for either they weren't healthy or they just weren't able to do what they were supposed to do. They weren't really helping Carson Wentz very much. He wasn't seeing what he wanted to see when he dropped back to throw the ball.
Bit of a Super Bowl hangover?
I don't know. Maybe so. Maybe some guys are just getting, I don't know what the deal is with Alshon Jeffrey. He had a calf injury early in the season. He just kind of, there were allegations that he was behind some anonymous grumbling in the media about Carson Wentz. And this is just kind of a fresh start with some guys that are really hungry and really certainly not questioning Carson Wentz's leadership or his style. I think it's kind of, you know, really given him a clean slate a little bit.
And he's hungry, too. He's hungry, too.
Yes, he really is. He's never been in the playoffs. You know, he's never been healthy for the playoffs. The 2 years the Eagles have made it since the previous 2 years the Eagles made the playoffs during his tenure, he was injured. So this is new territory to him, and he's very, very eager to get there and to make his mark.
So regular season, the Eagles have finished with a 9-7 record, and Doug Peterson, the coach, is being given a lot of credit for, you know, getting this, again, this banged up team, which had a really rough season, an up and down season to this point. Your colleague Marcus Hayes reports that after the Miami fiasco earlier this month, Peterson ordered a practice in full pads just days before the December 5th game, which apparently is not a popular move among the players that late in the season. What was the message here?
Yeah, I think the message was that it was time to get down to business. They had an extra day of preparation, and I think it was well-timed. The thing about the NFL late in the season is people are so banged up. You don't want to do anything strictly punitively that's going to make things worse in terms of how people are feeling and you know, what's physically possible for them. But they had an extra day of preparation because of the way the schedule worked. They had a Monday night game coming up after that Miami game. It was against the Giants. So with the extra day, he did a padded practice to kind of, you know,
wake them up, shock them into
pneumonia underneath the nostrils of the of the boxer who was getting a little punch drunk. So they, you know, I think it was a message. It's important to note here that Peterson is not known for being a taskmaster. I think his strength is his ability to relate to the players. He was a player. He makes reference to that all the time. He was a player at the very bottom rung who got cut and moved around the league and wasn't given a lot of, attention was really kind of understands what it's like to have to scramble and scrap. And I think his players really appreciate that, and he has a strong bond with them. And he kind of had the credibility to do something like this. I think coaches who are always like that, who are always punishing and reprimanding and demanding, I think that gets old really quick. But Peterson isn't like that. And for him to do something like that practice, I think players felt, wow, if he's at the end of his rope here, or if he's telling us it's time to buckle down, then we've really got to do it.
Yeah. Got about 30 seconds left, Les. And I guess important to remember, this Eagles squad heading into the postseason is not the same team, literally, as the one that won the Super Bowl a couple of years ago.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, it certainly isn't. That was a more talented team. They had a lot of injuries that year, too, though. In fact, they're probably
Wentz.
The most extraordinary Super Bowl winners of recent memory in that regard. But this is worse. This is much more challenging than that was. I think the offensive weapons were intact that year. They are not this year. But you never can tell. I mean, there really isn't the New England Patriots this year aren't what they once were. It's really hard to say, other than maybe the Baltimore Ravens, who's an unbeatable team out there. So we'll just have to see what happens and who the Eagles might get back along the way if they should win this week.
First step, yep, Seattle next Sunday. The adventure continues. Les Bowen, it was great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Very good to be here, Mary.
Les Bowen is sports writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget to join us on social media. Head to WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.